Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
No presidential meetings in Moscow. Are we leaving rubles on the table? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, August 7th. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. We begin today with Russia. Yes, it's the place where President Obama won't be meeting with Vladimir Putin, after Russia granted asylum to NSA leaker Edward Snowden. But it's also the largest economy in Europe, one that, despite some hiccups, grew at a pretty strong clip last year. An attractive target for many U.S. companies. So when diplomacy gets chilly, what does business do? Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
How closely are U.S. businesses watching the Obama-Putin spat? It depends who you are. If you're a huge multinational, you're really not worried about the bilateral bickering, according to Anders Osland, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Coca-Cola and McDonald's, Procter & Gamble are very big and very happy in Russia.
Boeing exports planes to Russia. GM sends cars. But other U.S. companies aren't so big and happy. They're still trying to get into the Russian market, which, by the way, loves Western products and can afford them. Steve Sestanovich handled Russian policy in the Clinton administration.
Moscow is just booming, and the money is everywhere to be seen.
U.S. companies still trying to latch on to the boom could feel the chilly breeze between the White House and Kremlin. It's not easy doing business in Russia. You have to slog through miles of red tape, and Russian bureaucrats could see Putin's behavior as a signal to throw up roadblocks to American investors. Moyara Rusin teaches international economics at the Monterey Institute.
If you're an investor and you're trying to build a factory inside of Russia, then you're going to have to start begging for favors from people within the Russian government. And so, yeah, that's going to get tricky.
Rusin says Russia isn't a huge market for the U.S., especially compared to China and Brazil. For now, at least, that's not likely to change. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
It's August, and kids across the country are getting ready to go back to school. Or dreading it. In Georgia, one school with an eye-popping price tag opened its doors today. $147 million. That buys North Atlanta High School a 600-seat theater, a food court-style cafeteria with a smoothie bar, and more than 50 acres of athletic fields. But here's another, less impressive number. North Atlanta has a graduation rate of only 60%. School leaders hope this investment will help turn things around. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports on whether that's too much to ask of a building.
You get the picture. This isn't your average high school. But it's not all about the bells and whistles.
All the rooms will have smart boards, will be wired for Wi-Fi and computer access. We have things like a 3D graphics lab.
That's Atlanta Board of Education Chairman Ruben McDaniel, whose daughter will be a freshman there. He says this is a school for the future. It's also a school that has a lot of taxpayers in Georgia questioning whether it's all worth it, especially since the project came in $50 million over budget.
The most important piece is creating expectations that are high. And so I think that over the next couple of years, the taxpayers will see that not only do they have a great building, but they have a great school.
That's going to depend in part on this high-priced new school getting more kids across the finish line. Right now, only about 60% graduate. The school's roughly 1,400 students are a broad mix. About half are black, 20% Hispanic, the rest white. Some come from wealth, others are homeless. David Thompson is an education professor at Kansas State. He says feeling good about where you are every day matters.
There's an enormous amount of really good research that shows that the amount of pride in a school building, discipline problems decrease, level of learning increases.
Thompson says a fancy building isn't as important as student-to-teacher ratios or the quality of instructors and support staff. But North Atlanta High beats the days when we built cinder block schools with almost no windows. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Tesla Motors posted earnings today. The electric car company announced a quarterly loss, but it did better than Wall Street expected. CEO Elon Musk said recently he wants to cut car prices in half within 4 years. That $70,000 price point was a little steep for most of us. And General Motors is already cutting the price of its Chevy Volt. Stan Alcorn looks into what it takes to make an electric car that's both affordable and profitable.
You can buy an electric car today for under $20,000, if you're in the right state. William Cook oversees a program in Georgia that hands out a $5,000 tax credit to anyone who buys a zero-emissions vehicle.
You get a lot more people who are interested, and that now becomes a vehicle that people can actually afford.
That tax break comes on top of a $7,500 federal tax credit and new manufacturer discounts. Nissan cut the price of the all-electric Leaf from the mid-30s to $29,000, and Chevrolet just announced it's knocking $5,000 off its $40,000 Volt. Chevy spokeswoman Michelle Melko.
By lowering the price, it gives us the opportunity to be on the shopping list of consumers.
Whether the manufacturers are making any money on them at that price, I don't think so.
John O'Dell is a green car specialist at Edmunds.com. He says the big car manufacturers are making zero-emission vehicles in part because California and several other states require them to.
There's an incentive right there to build them, even if you have to lose money on each one. You make your money up on your high-profit stuff.
Like gas-guzzling pickup trucks. But O'Dell says the discounts are also about creating a genuine market for electric vehicles.
More than all the advertising you can do, more than, you know, all the spiffs you can put on it, the thing that sells cars is when you see one in your neighbor's garage.
Still, O'Dell thinks it will be decades before drivers buy enough electric cars to make them cost competitive without the tax breaks. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, weak earnings push all three indices down. We'll have details when we do the numbers. A lot of jobs are hard, and quite a few are dangerous. Wildland firefighter is very hard and among the most dangerous. 29 wildland firefighters have died this year in the line of duty, including 19 in Arizona back in June. We're going to meet two people today who work those big western wildfires. One veteran, whose job it is to help firefighters manage risk and sometimes loss on the fire lines. The other is just starting out. What's unusual is it's a family affair. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has our story.
Let me take you back a few weeks to mid-July. The Mountain Fire east of Los Angeles has just burst out from a bone-dry pine scrub hillside. The resort town of Idlewild is evacuated. 40 square miles of national forest land are ablaze. Up in Oregon, Janine Summey has been waiting.
I've been on 2-hour call, and then this morning my orders came in, and about 9 o'clock I left.
Quick flight into L.A., and I've now reached Summey in her Forest Service vehicle as she's heading up into the foothills to the base camp near Idlewild, a few miles from the fire lines, to report for duty.
Now that I'm here and, like, I'm about to engage, I get really excited and a little bit nervous just because I know that I'm entering into the unknown.
Back in her 20s, Summey would have been carrying axe and shovel to fight the fire. Now, in her mid-40s, she still wears the ugly flame-retardant pants and a two-way radio. She's now on a federal command team that flies in for the biggest fires. She's the human resources specialist, managing 3,500 firefighters. A few days later, I head out to meet her. Base camp is like a small city. Hundreds of fire trucks, hotshot buggies, a helicopter landing field. Tents and trailers for the command team. They call this Main Street.
Our function as a human resource specialist is to keep a pulse on, you know, what's happening with the humans who are on the fires.
And, you know, let me ask, since it's top of mind, is your job different after the tragic deaths in Arizona?
People are hurting. One of the fascinating things about the firefighter personality is the amazing ability to put off your emotions until the crisis has passed. And you have to keep doing the work that you're doing despite the fact that your heart is broken.
fire behavior.
Okay, specifically tonight, what I would caution everybody, where we have the primary heat on this fire right now up here on the north end, what's carrying...
Now, you'll already have figured out one unusual thing about Sami. She's a woman. Easily 90% of the firefighters here are men. And here's unusual thing number two.
She just texted me. She just got dispatched to Montana.
Sami's talking about her 19-year-old daughter, Iris, now in her second summer fighting wildfires.
Because they're doing initial attacks, she had a 25-and-a-half-hour work shift that she just did. She said, Mom, I'm pretty tired, but she did a little smiley face and was happy.
I am in eastern Montana. It's kind of out in the middle of nowhere.
I reached Iris by cell phone at the end of her shift. On her crew, there are a few more women than when her mother was out on the fire lines, 6 out of 20.
It is a masculine type of community, and you do hard work every day, and you're dirty.
The jokes are dirty, too, though Iris says it doesn't bother her. She likes the money. With overtime and hazard pay, she'll make nearly $10,000 this summer for college. Mom Janine says she's damn proud of her strong, capable daughter. But remember how excited Janine was heading into the firefighting unknown? Not so much for her daughter.
Every night I've texted her and said, please be careful, eat well, hydrate.
I know it's a dangerous job, and I know people do get hurt, and sometimes people die. It's just my personality, I'm not afraid of much anything.
Mother and daughter both safe now back at home until the next fire call comes. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Computers are getting smaller and smaller. You can hold them in the palm of your hand, like smartphones. But what about actually in your hand? You know, inside. Computer chips implanted in your body are already a reality. And as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports, businesses are eager to get in on the cyborg action.
Being part man, part machine seems like something from the future.
With the implant in my nervous system, we literally plug me into a computer and hence onto the internet.
Kevin Warwick is a professor of cybernetics at Reading University in England. He's also the world's first cyborg. Warwick had a chip implanted in his forearm that connected him to a computer at Columbia University in New York.
We plugged my nervous system into the internet and connected to a robot hand, which was back in England. I moved my hand in New York, but my brain signals also were sent via the internet to move the robot hand in England.
The experiment was funded by Nortel and Computer Associates, among others. The market for chips in the body is already worth about $8 billion a year. That's almost entirely medical. Companies like Medtronic are developing chips that could help victims of paralysis, schizophrenia, and even blindness.
That kind of launched me into the subculture of do-it-yourself implants.
Rich Lee is an entrepreneur in St. George, Utah. He's going blind, so he had chips implanted in his ears that will help him navigate the way bats do.
Use some echolocation by hooking it up to a rangefinder that will send back information to my implants to tell me how close or far away an object is.
The leap from medical body chips to tracking chips is what keeps Corinne Carey up at night. She's a technology expert with the New York Civil Liberties Union.
The technology is there, and it's a question of how we choose as a society to allow it to be used.
Carey says chips in the body mean that eventually we could be tracked the way our computers and devices already are. But for cybernetics professor Kevin Warwick, privacy is beside the point.
Those that have neurological implants for enhancement will really be an evolutionary step on from the humans that decide just to stay as they are, that they're going to be left behind.
Warwick predicts the commercial market is less than a decade away. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up,
He was yelling. He was pacing back and forth, telling the employees, I don't care. Call the police. Arrest me. I want them to arrest me.
So how was your day at work? But first, let's do the numbers. It's day three of losses on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 48 points, or 0.3%, to land at 15,470. The NASDAQ lost 11 points, also 0.3%, ending at 3,654. The S&P 500 dipped 6 points, about 0.3%, closing at 1,690. First Solar, the largest solar manufacturer in the U.S., fell short on expected profits. The company's stock dropped 13% today. Housing stocks took a hit. D.R. Horton and rival Toll Brothers both knocked off 3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.6%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, President Obama meets with the Prime Minister of Greece at the White House. The annual National Hobo Convention gets underway in Britt, Iowa. Crafts, a parade, and a memorial service are all part of the event. And she spent a whole lot of time in the water. Swimmer and actress Esther Williams was born on August 8, 1921. She died earlier this year at the age of 91. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Britain is in a spat over one of its last remaining colonies. That's Gibraltar. It takes up 2.5 square miles on the rocky southern tip of the Spanish mainland. For centuries, Spain has claimed the territory. And now it's threatening reprisals against the British colony in a dispute that's supposedly over fishing. Or is it? From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The Rock of Gibraltar has been called the pebble in Spain's shoe, a constant source of annoyance. The latest row flared up after Gibraltar laid an artificial concrete reef in disputed waters, hindering Spanish fishermen. Spain wants it removed. Fabian Picardo, chief minister in the self-governing territory, says no way.
What won't happen is that decisions made by the executive in Gibraltar will be undone because of Spanish saber-rattling. Hell will freeze over before that happens.
But the saber-rattling is intense. Spain has imposed new travel controls, causing long delays at the border. It's talked about a levy of $65 on anyone who wants to cross into Spain. It's even threatening to close its airspace to planes headed for Gibraltar. All about fish? Senior British lawmaker Ming Campbell thinks not.
This reef may just have been the opportunity the Spanish government was looking for in order to try and divert attention for its very obvious difficulties at home.
The Spanish government's been engulfed by a corruption scandal which has been knocked temporarily from the headlines by the Gibraltar spat. For his part, British Prime Minister David Cameron is backing the Rock.
I think it's important that we recognise that it's not acceptable what's been happening to the people of Gibraltar. I'm very clear that Britain will always stand up for the people of Gibraltar.
Fighting talk, but this isn't war. There's too much at stake. Last year, 13.5 million Brits spent their summer vacations in Spain. The Gibraltar Reef seems unlikely to wreck Anglo-Spanish relations. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Remember the old dog days of summer? When the whole point of sleepaway camp was to escape your parents' prying eyes. A kid could spend an entire summer wearing the same dirty clothes and no one would notice. But these days, as campers are learning, Big Mother is never far away. Commentator Beth Titel explains.
Let's pity, if just for a moment, helicopter parents with kids at sleepaway camp. They should be enjoying a break from their self-imposed duties. But letting go is hard, particularly since most camps enforce strict no-cell-phone rules. That reduces mom and dad to scouring the camp's website for newly uploaded photos in hopes of catching a glimpse of their offspring. Oh, you didn't know? With competition for campers intense, most camps now dispatch a photographer to stroll the campus and capture the simple, old-fashioned joy that $13,000 for a 7-week session at the high end can bring. It's an attempt to please the people paying for the bug juice. But as camp directors know, photos don't necessarily calm worries. No sooner do the shots go online than the calls start. He looks plump. What are you feeding him? Why is she standing alone? It's raining. Why isn't he wearing the coat I sent? How come he's not smiling? And even more painful, why aren't there any pictures of my child? When camps get that last call, they send out the photographer. But some children don't want to be captured. As one camp consultant told me, yes, that's a real position. The kid will say, why are you taking my picture? I'm fine. With the camp season heading into the home stretch, some parents admit to checking for uploaded photos hourly, and a YouTube video mocking the behavior has gotten more than 160,000 hits. In it, a sleepaway camp mom repeatedly blurts out the word refresh while talking to a confused non-camp mom. Online camp photos have become such big business, the practice is trickling down to day camps. That puts day camp moms, like me, in a funny position. We can go straight from nagging our children about screen time to ooing over photos of them taken mere hours earlier.
Beth Tytel is a reporter at the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth. Here are three little letters guaranteed to fill you with dread. DMV. Tough to stay positive when you know you're going to spend some quality time at the Department of Motor Vehicles. Maybe waiting in line to renew a license or update your registration. For the latest in our series, You Hate My Job, the DMV in Pasadena, right outside Los Angeles. An hour before the doors open, there's already a 25-person line. And it starts with Adam Pena. Are you first in line?
Yes.
What are you here for at the DMV?
Driver's license and ID.
Do you have a mindset that you're already in? Like, are you coming into the DMV ready to do battle?
No, I'm coming in to wait. I know that's what I'm going to be fighting is the line.
I've been looking at the facial expressions of the people waiting in line. Nobody looks particularly happy to be
miserable.
Here.
Miserable. They look miserable.
And if you work there? Cynthia Lara is a manager, but even so, still works the window at the Pasadena DMV. She's been with the DMV for 15 years.
It is a good job. It is, you know, job security. I mean, that's what everybody says. Oh, you're lucky you work at the DMV. It's job security. To me, the DMV is the lowest paid, you know, state agency that, you know, is out there. And I think, wow, and we collect the most money.
What's it like doing a job where people are prepared to not like you?
The first interaction, they come in and they're already mad, you know. So me, I like changing that, trying to see, okay, I know what your mood is. Okay, you feel this, you feel that. And I'm like, all right. So I know how to approach it. And to me, it's like a challenge, you know. They're mad, they're yelling or something. And then at the very end, they're like, wow, thank you, you know. And then that right there is gratifying.
What's the toughest situation you've ever dealt with here?
Well, it wasn't at this office. It was at another office. This customer, he was yelling. He was pacing back and forth, telling the employees, I don't care. Call the police. Arrest me. I want them to arrest me. And he was telling me, I need my registration to my car. There was tickets, over $1,000 of parking tickets on the car. And that is not our fault. But everybody, you know, puts all their collections to the DMV. And I'm like, okay. I go, this is what you need to do. This is what has to happen. If you want to get your car out of the impound, this is what has to happen. You're going to have to pay the tickets. I go, after you pay the tickets, take your receipt that we give you to the parking bureau and then find out what you could do to fight them. I go, and maybe they can refund the money. I go, but right now to get your car out, you're going to need to pay everything. He calmed down. He pulled out his checkbook. He goes, tell me how much. And even the employees were all, how did you do that? And I'm like, they just wanted you, you know, to listen.
I think if I went home and told my family, I just interviewed this woman who works at the DMV. She's been working here for 15 years, and she is relentlessly cheerful. It would blow their minds.
You're gonna make me cry. No. Thank you.
out in the lobby.
Now serving F.
The doors have opened and the DMV is already filling with people. Cynthia takes a position at a window.
Have you had a California ID or permit before? This is your first time?
There are about 200 people here, some standing, some sitting in plastic chairs, waiting for their numbers to be called.
May I help the next person?
Remember Adam Pena? He was first in line outside this morning. Now he's standing at one of the windows.
First one in line, that's what happens.
You're almost done?
I'm waiting for the lady to get back. Hopefully I'm out of here in 5 minutes.
And that'll be what, about 2 hours total?
2 hours and 5 minutes total.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you please sign in Day right here?
Other interviews in our series, You Hate My Job, have included a meter maid and a bankruptcy lawyer. You can listen to them at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we learn that all offices share some bureaucratic constants: org charts, promotions, conference calls, even Al-Qaeda. The Daily Beast reported that the tip that led to closing embassies in the Middle East and Africa came from an Al-Qaeda conference call. Yes, really. More than 20 Al-Qaeda operatives were reportedly on the call that worried U.S. intelligence officials. A board meeting of sorts, complete with a promotion announcement. A meeting that an intelligence official described as, quote, like a meeting of the Legion of Doom. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 48 points, or 0.3%. The NASDAQ lost 11 points, also 0.3%. And the S&P 500 dipped 6 points, about 0.3%. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the program for us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll meet you back here again tomorrow. This is APM.